This week's episode is about teaching. We originally recorded this and I thought it was going to be about teaching in COVID, but I'm just here to tell you we sort of switched it up. So enjoy the episode and let us know what you think. Hey, my name is Martha.
And this is Colby on Martha and Colby Grow Up,
a podcast where we talk about the things that made us who we are and where we're going in the future.
Because every week we're finding a new way that we're growing up.
Hi, I'm Martha.
And this is Colby on Martha and Colby Grow Up,
a podcast where 20-somethings navigate life apart together. Welcome back. It's been a while. Last you heard us, we were talking about spooky things and how we both don't like Halloween. Colby, did you survive Halloween? How did that go for you?
It makes me laugh that our Halloween episode was about how we don't like Halloween. Yeah, it was good. It was a good time. It was a bad time. I watched a football game and it did not end well for us. Yeah, we played Virginia. We lost and dropped out of the top 25. So, yeah, not a good time. Bad Halloween.
How are the Gophers doing this year? I haven't looked at them. Are they good? Last year we were good.
Let me tell you how much I think about Big Ten football because it is not very often.
All right, I'll look that up on my own time then. We have, as always, a question of the week, parentheses of the month, close parentheses, and that is, what is your favorite soda / pop / varietal of Coke? I almost said it like Coke, like I wanted to say Colby, but Coke. Anyways, Colby.
My favorite, I mean, to stay on brand with not watching Big Ten football and saying aggressively Southern, I'm going to say Cheerwine.
I don't know what that is. Could you describe it for me?
Yeah, it's a cherry soda.
Maybe we have talked. I feel like you've talked about this before.
Yeah, whenever I go to Cookout again, extremely North Carolina, our guest is laughing at me right now. Whenever I go to Cookout, I always get like a huge Cheerwine to go with my food. It's a good compliment.
I will have to try sometime when I go to the South. Just the South in general. Anything south of Minnesota is the South.
Really, you need to come to North Carolina. I'm not sure if they sell it anywhere else.
All right. Sounds good. My favorite soda / pop / varietal of Coke is Mexican Fanta. And it's specifically Mexican because it is full sugar and it tastes so good. I feel like normal pop can have a lot of carbonation and that kind of like either could make you sick. It makes you like more full. But I can just like guzzle down an entire bottle of Mexican Fanta because it doesn't. It's like less carbonation and more sugar, and it just tastes so good. I recently discovered that Jarritos have similar taste. So while I can't get Mexican Fanta in Minnesota, I can get something close. Anyways, we have a guest this week, and before we introduce him, we will ask him the same question. Sam, what is your favorite pop / soda / Coke varietal?
So I really think the correct answer here is Dr. Pepper. However, I will do an available in North Carolina shout out to another classic carbonated beverage, which is Sun Drop, which is just delightful.
Is that really a North Carolina thing? I didn't know.
Well, it's actually, so it's canned in Middle Tennessee. But it's very difficult to get outside of North Carolina. You can find it, but North Carolina is pretty much where it's most widely available.
Today I learned. I didn't know that. I guess I haven't really been looking for Sun Drop outside of North Carolina either. So
I think Dr. Pepper is absolutely the incorrect choice, but as you are our guest, that's all I'll say about it.
Huh.
We have a guest today, and his name is Sam, and Sam is an assistant professor of English at a small public university in the South. He reads, writes about, and teaches YA fiction. Sam, is there anything else you want to tell us about yourself?
Well, I mean, I'm sure that everybody here is very familiar with Colby's football leanings. I guess what I should probably add to that is I'm born and bred and came to, honestly, my Tennessee Volunteer fandom. And so it's been a hard year. It's been a hard decade.
It's been a hard life since 1998. Like it's been a while.
it has been a while. Yeah, our game got postponed this weekend, so that's neat.
Every goddamn podcast I'm on with Colby, he starts talking about sports. Like literally everyone we record.
I didn't start this episode. Yeah, you asked about Minnesota football.
We're gonna stop it right now.
He was on our podcast and I started talking about mixtapes and it became a whole thing. So I just wanted to start off with some common ground this time. And I thought that was important.
I appreciate it. And what podcast do you host?
I am the co-host of Monkey Off My Backlog, which is a pop culture productivity podcast. Both of you have guessed it so far, so hopefully some of your listeners have also checked us out. But if not, hey.
We are going to be discussing teaching and coronavirus because Sam is a professor. I have several teacher friends in my orbital, but no professors really. So we wanted to have you on to sort of see how your life has changed. You know, is this your first year of teaching? And if so, is this your first year teaching? I don't think I know the answer to that question. No.
So you want me to tell you?
Please.
You want me to keep it a secret? You want to guess? We can make it a game.
Sure. Okay. Well, I know. I think you're going to say something like snooty and you're going to be like, well, I actually student taught. So I think you're going to say that. But I think this is probably your first or second year as an actual professor.
That's true. That is true.
Thank you.
I don't know what your background is, like how much you've bounced around. So maybe if you were at a larger public university, you maybe had like some sort of recitation sort of thing where there are like breakout classes that you go to that you might have led before. I don't know. That's where I'm leaning. Some sort of TA situation.
Well, so what's interesting about that is with English composition, you know, so your freshman level comp, it really doesn't work that way where you have like the big lecture and then the TA, you know, does like the discussion thing like you described. A teaching assistant in an English program is usually just the person who teaches the course.
I guess that's true. Now that I think about my comp class, yeah.
I skipped freshman level comp. I tested out.
I wish I could. It was impossible at Carolina to test out.
Well, not anymore. Not anymore.
Oh, yeah, true. Not anymore.
They fixed that.
Yeah, as soon as I graduate, it's easier to test out of.
Yeah, I was actually just talking to a student about that today, about how they used to make it impossible there. And then the state was like, no, a 3 is going to get you.
I got a freaking 4 in AP Lit and Lang and couldn't test out.
Oh, gotta get a 5.
Really? Yeah.
Oh, so at the University of Minnesota, SkyUMa, we had I took a college in the schools class. So I think I got like a B+ in that. It was, I think it was basically like lit 1001 at the University of Minnesota, and that counted for the comp credit. So I didn't take AP Lit or Lang because I was not that good at English. Because I don't know, I wasn't good at school. So,
so our first question for you, Sam, how are you? How are you doing?
I am so tired. Just so tired.
You really sound like it.
No, that's actually just my normal voice. we've joked that I need to record it like, you know, like a speed, like 10x, like 110%, you know, just so. But then Tessa would be the same speed and it wouldn't work.
I feel like I'm a little bit tuned up because I've had some wine. So, anyways, side note, you can swear on this podcast. It is explicit.
Right.
Yeah, it used to be shit you need to know. So.
Yeah. I always forget to tell people that because people are like, oh, can I swear? Like when it used to just be me and I'm like, do you know the name of the podcast? Is shit you need to know? Like, yeah, you can swear. Anyways. So are you tired because of the state of the world? Or I guess like how, when you, if this is your first or second year of being a professor and things have obviously not, you know, worked out in the way you probably thought it was going to be, how has that sort of affected your life and just general mindset, I guess?
Yeah, so this is my 19th year of teaching. You know, I've taught at the college level quite a bit. Six of those years were high school English. To go back to something you said earlier, well, I actually student taught. I was 3 weeks into student teaching when 9/11 happened. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, this is nothing like that. That was just, it was like 3 weeks later, and we were pretty much okay. So this is much different. So I started this particular job last fall. Before that, I had, the spring before that, I had taught a course completely online for the first time. So I've been at this for a while. I have experience teaching online. It should have been okay. You know, I was not one of those people who was new to the game. I was not one of those people who was unfamiliar with teaching online. So it should have been okay. And it has not been. You know, the elements of the teaching have been very taxing. You know, obviously more detail if you like, but there's just so much more time consuming to try to do things the right way. There's managing student stress. And then there's the additional things that this job has that I didn't have previous experience with. I coordinate an entire degree program as part of my job. That is something that no sane first year or second year or third year or fourth year, maybe even fifth year assistant professor would do, but that's what I was hired to do. So I was less than a year into adjusting to that when this happened. And by the way, it's a completely new program. Nobody's ever done it before at this university. So there were a lot of things, and that doesn't even touch on the fact that, you know, I'm English education. I haven't stepped a foot into any high school around here and can't for the near future, but I'm still trying to like build relationships, still trying to get to know the community. And we still haven't talked about scholarship and trying to work on publications and conference presentations. It's just been a lot.
So what classes are you actually teaching?
So right now, this is super fun. So this semester, I am teaching two sections of freshman English composition. And actually, I should clarify that my position is normally four courses a semester. But because I'm a program coordinator, I only teach three because my program coordinator duties take up a lot of time, right? So I should be teaching three classes. So two of them are English composition. I am also teaching a new course that I wrote. That is all about lesson planning, understanding curriculum, assessments, educational technology. It's a lot of stuff. I am also teaching a Foundations of Reading course. I am also teaching an English Language Arts Methods course. And I am also supervising a student who is doing student teaching in the field.
So you're doing a lot of like pedagogy. I'm not sure which one it is.
I think it's goji.
How has this experience of you getting thrown into all these things while a pandemic is happening and having to, I mean, I'm assuming, kind of reorient yourself in how you're going about teaching, how has that impacted, you know, what you're telling your students or how you're writing your curriculums?
Yeah, and quickly to add on to that, how do you feel that, like, do you feel that you are still able to deliver all of what you need to online? Or do you think the content has suffered because it's been, you know, not face-to-face?
Well, and I don't think it's any controversial thing. I think most people would agree that everything has suffered in terms of education. My goal during this whole process has been, well, during the spring, it was really just let's get through, let's get to the end. But this fall, it's been a matter of, okay, if you take out all the bells and whistles, what absolutely has to happen in these courses? And then let's do that. And that's it. And one thing that's come out of that, and again, because, you know, students are really stressed out, understandably. And so, you know, I know what needs to happen. And I had a plan. Week to week, I'm changing the plan. You know, it's like, okay, how are we? Let me see how I think we're doing this week. You know, what do I need to do to kind of make it easier on them? Not to make the material easier, but to make their lives easier. And there's always adjustments, even in the best of semesters. But this has just been a constant state of adjustment. So it's been a real challenge in that way. I think at the end of the day, they'll walk out with what they absolutely need, but I'm not happy about it.
Can you talk more about when you said that you are carrying some of the emotional weight for your students? Because, you know, I'm friends with Tessa, your wife, and she has said the same thing. And, you know, our other co-host of the Four Nations Report, Ariel, has said the same thing. So what does that look like? Because I guess I'm sort of thinking in my life, it's pretty much just me. I mean, I work for a company. I can work remotely. It's far less stressful than teaching, it seems. I think if I had to maybe extend it to more than a few people at a time, I think I would lose it. I think, frankly, like, that would be too difficult for me. So how are you managing that?
Well, and, you know, not every teacher in the best of times, not every teacher chooses to carry the emotional labor of their students. And I'm not saying it's the best decision or the worst decision, but the small sample size that you named, we are certainly all doing that. And I think most teachers do. So it's nothing new. It's just much, much, much more heightened. I'm familiar with students coming to me and disclosing illnesses, family member illnesses, deaths, suicides, any manner of things. This is not my first time in any of that. But this is like boss level. I mean, it's all happening at once. I had a student today. You know, just ask that, you know, I make a big, in my syllabus, I have this thing that happens every semester where I say, you know, if you need something, you need to tell me. If there's something going on in your life, I mean, you don't have to tell me what it is, but if it's something that's affecting your ability to do the best you can in this course, let me know that something is happening so I can work it out with you. And that's always been there. But it's never been in this volume. And the thing about it is I know there are at least as many who are choosing not to say anything and are just suffering through it, which I don't like. But that's the way the system's set up. And, you know, that's also a problem. But it's really difficult to disengage. And the thing on top of that is working from home, right? So if you're working from home, when do you clock out and leave? The temptation is, it's right over there. Let me just see if anything's happened. And something has always happened. So it's been a lot. And how have I handled it? Not well. Not well.
But you're here with us, and you're smiling. And you know what? I think we should celebrate that you can still smile right now.
I think so, too. And I'm just thinking how, you know, and I've talked about it on this podcast before, is that when I was a freshman in college, I had pretty bad depression. Like, it was pretty bad. And I'm just thinking, if I had a teacher like you that was like an open and was like, hey, you know, come to me, can we figure this out together, whatever. I would have been probably in a completely different place that first year of college. But instead, I just sort of, you know, wasn't. Like I weathered it alone, and I thought that's just what you were supposed to do. So, I don't know. Maybe I haven't given enough credit to teachers in my past that have been nice to me.
So, Sam, you mentioned that you've stripped your courses down to the bare bones, like what you need to know about XYZ. What do you think has been lost? I mean, you know what's lost, but like, what are the sorts of things that just can't happen right now?
Well, you know, that it, I don't want to say that after so many years of teaching composition, my brain goes on autopilot. That's not true. But there are things that I think just come to me. It's like, okay, this is the day where you do this thing and, you know, you had this discussion. And so now that I've been severed from the classroom, those things that do kind of just automatically pop up haven't automatically popped up, or they popped up on a delay. And so, you know, there's those things, I remembered last week to talk about my audience, my reader metaphor. One of my favorite things to do is tell stories that I think are funny, but nobody else does. And here's one. So sometime in the first few weeks of class, when I'm teaching composition, I'll say, so, you know, it's really important to lead your reader through what you're writing. Part of the point of any kind of communication, whether it's writing or anything else, is to take what's in your head and provide that to somebody else. And a lot of the times we leave out the things that seem super obvious to us because it seems super obvious to us. But that's actually the stuff you need to write down, because we think about things differently. You know, if we were all a hive mind, there'd be no need for writing. But because it's not that way, we need to really guide our reader through our thought process. And, you know, that sounds fine and they don't get it. But here's the metaphor that works. Imagine you're at Walmart with a small child, nephew, niece, don't care, small child, five-ish. You know, they can walk on their own pretty good. But you've had to park pretty far down the parking lot, right? And you know what Walmart parking lots are like. I don't know what they're like in Minnesota, but Colby, you know what I'm talking about.
They don't have Walmarts up there yet.
Okay, so Target.
I was just trying to say that.
The jankiest Target. I don't know what to tell
okay,
you.
Okay.
But anyway, so you get out of the car and, you know, you could say to the child, hey, small child who knows how to walk, why don't you go on and go ahead and meet me at the Walmart entrance? I'll be right there. And that child's going to walk all the way through the Walmart parking lot by themselves. Now, it's possible they could come out of that okay. But you know they're not going to. Something's going to happen. And so what you do, and so usually at this point I say, what do you do? And they're like, well, somebody will say, well, you take the child by the hand. And you know, you kind of walk with them up to the entrance. And I'm like, that's what you do with a reader when you write. It's not that you can't trust them. They're not stupid. You're just the person who is responsible, who is able to get them safely where they need to go. And that seems to work for people, that story that catches a few people. I just remembered last week I hadn't told them that story, so I put it in a video and uploaded it.
Gotcha.
That was a really long-winded answer, but that it's that kind of thing. It's the art of teaching, if you want to call that art.
It's the rhythm.
Yeah, I mean,
you know where the beats are.
That's pretty much what it is. And the other thing too is, like, I really hate that I can't go into the high school classroom where my person is student teaching and watch. I hate that. I hate that I have to see a recording of a Zoom session.
Do you ever, sorry, this is not related to COVID at all. When you're doing those sorts of, like, sitting in and watching sorts of things, do you, like, comment while they're teaching, or is it just like after everything's over, it's like, okay, you did this, mate, let's talk about that?
So you watch, anybody watch Top Chef?
I watch, yeah. Top Chef.
Okay. So you know that thing that Tom does while they're all cooking, and he just kind of walks around, he's like, hey, what you doing?
That's like Paul Hollywooding Bake Off.
What are you working on? You know that?
Mm-hmm.
So no, I do not want to be, I don't want to ruin that teacher's flow when I'm observing.
Right.
I mean, if there's a train wreck, I'll step in, you know, like I'm prepared. But usually, because we teach student-centered learning, they're going to be working individually or in groups at some point during the observation. So I will take it upon myself to get up and just kind of meander around and talk to students and see how it's going. And of course, you know, the person who's being observed is freaking out because what are they telling them? that's what I like to do. And really the place to talk and to intervene is afterward when we have a conference and just, you know, get how the person felt about it. And then I'm able to ask some tough questions, but also, unless things have gone seriously wrong, which even when they have gone wrong, I've been able to come up with some good things that have happened. So
this is a two-part question. One, how do you feel now that Betsy DeVos will likely be out of office? And two, what are your sort of hopes for the future of teaching, the future of education? That's kind of a broad question. So it could be in terms of like, you know, once we get past this corona hump, what do you think is going to happen? You can take it in any direction you want. I just gave you a lot of ground, I guess.
Also, the corona hump is my favorite 60s dance craze. Go ahead. You can proceed now.
That was good. That was good.
This is one of those things that's going to make me and only me laugh.
No. You deserve recognition for that. I really appreciate that.
I wouldn't go that far, Sam. Don't inflate his ego.
You're the one that has to deal with them, not me.
That is absolutely correct.
So Betsy DeVos. But let me not talk about Betsy DeVos because that one's obvious. Let me go back further. Arnie Duncan, President Obama's education person.
Is that the tall dude to play basketball?
He was a Chicago guy. Are you thinking about this? I don't know if he played basketball or not.
Oh, yeah, that's him. He was a real big dude. He always played in the Celebrity All-Star Game. Mm. That's how,
well, now
of
I
course,
know.
That's how I know who he is.
So Arnie Duncan was not a great education guy. Still isn't. One of his top cronies was superintendent of schools for a district where I worked in a large city in the state that you're in, Colby.
Mm.
And that guy went to work for Fox News afterwards. So Arnie Duncan was he was very, very not politically aligned with Dr. Jill Biden, for example. So we went from bad to worse with Betsy, but Dr. Biden is awesome. I just have very strong feelings about her. She's somebody who's taught freshman comp. She has an EDD, so she's very aligned with the kind of thing that I do, and I'm very happy. I hope that she takes a heavy hand in education policy, because I think that'll only mean good things. As far as what needs to change, we don't have time to go into all the things, but I'll give you a couple quick hits. First of all, public funding of private schools and charter schools needs to be put in a coffin, buried underground, and just kept there.
I'm very quietly clapping for those not watching.
So, one of the big things about our system of public education, and it has many flaws, and there's not a lot of good things to say about it right now because of the direction it's headed. But one of the best things that we can say about it is that it is meant to be a truly democratic enterprise. We have this notion here, and we don't stick to it. But we have this notion that every child in this country deserves education. It is a right. It's not a privilege. And that is not a common position. There are a lot of places that have better educational systems than we have. But we have a very interesting population in this country, a very diverse, which is great, population. But it makes education for all, a very challenging thing. And the last thing we need to do is encourage groups of people to opt out and go somewhere else, because it makes the diversity less and the possibilities less. But if they're going to do that, I certainly can't stop them. But I don't like the idea of public funds going there, because we need to support this democratic enterprise of public education that we have. And of course, after that, you know, resource the places, infrastructure, teacher pay. I've actually written about this. Teacher pay comes with responsibility, that we fix teacher pay, and then we hold teachers to a higher standard. You know, it's not money for nothing. You got to step up. We have to do better about policing our own and holding teachers to a very high pedagogical standard. So, yeah, there's a few things.
I've talked about this on this podcast. I went to a fancy magnet school for elementary school, but it was a public school, so everyone could go. But my thing about magnet schools and these other types of like specialized, like Montessori's, other types of public schools, what I hear a lot is that, well, we want the choice of charter school, or like the choice of private schools. Like, you still can have those choices with public education.
Absolutely. I went to a magnet school. It was actually a K through 12 magnet school. I went there from 7 through 12. And I was in a very, very white district. Suburban, moving into rural white district. And I was drowning there. I was not supported as a student. I did not like most of the people that I was around. You know, and when I moved to the magnet school, you know, it was great. You know, there were teachers who wanted to be there because it was a good place to be. You know, that's really where I learned to just be comfortable with the idea of seeing people who did not look like me. And I don't think that's any really great thing. I mean, I don't think that, like, that there's no credit due there. It's just, it just became natural. So when I went to Knoxville and started my undergrad, I was like, where did all these white people come from? You know, it was weird. But those kinds of experiences, like you say, you know, like public magnet experiences are really nice. Absolutely. There is space for those kinds of experiences. And by the way, if we were willing to invest in public education, we could come up with any other opportunity that you could dream up within that system.
I really have enjoyed my public education. I mean, I didn't go to magnet school. I went to public school all the way through college. Haven't gone to post-grad yet, probably never will, but I feel like, especially at my public school, yes, Minnesota is a very white state, but we did have a pretty diverse student body at high school and in the whole district as well. I think it was just, we were sort of that first ring suburb outside like the city of Minneapolis and the city of St. Paul. So I think some of that maybe have bled over. I don't know. Don't quote me, but yeah. I mean, like, to your point, I feel like investing in public education is an incredibly smart thing to do and will have lots of good, you know, benefits to pay off down the line. I mean, I had a math teacher in public high school. I'm terrible at math. I literally hate it so much. I don't use it in my daily life. But I had a math teacher, and he was so incredibly nice. And I had to take calculus my first year of college, didn't understand it. And I could still email my old teacher and be like, hey, can you help me? Like, I know this is, you know, your thing, but I just feel like, and I don't know if this is true of private schools because I only went to public school, but a lot of the experiences I had were teachers going above and beyond, even though they didn't have to, which I think is, I wonder if that's like a personality trait that teachers have, or if really empathetic people are attracted to becoming teachers. I don't know. It's interesting that I've enjoyed most of the teachers that I've had my whole life, minus some college professors.
If I keep praising Matt in schools, if you would allow me for just like one more second, I think something that's interesting about magnet schools is that since at least mine didn't have a district, it was just like pick the kids up and put them in the school. It really adds to the diversity of the school because it, no, that's not true. Everywhere in the country, like white people tend to live with white people, Asian people live with Asian people, black people live with black people. So in places like Charlotte in North Carolina, you have like the super white schools and like the schools that are like that have a high percentage of black students. You really, unless you're in one of the more rural counties that only have one high school that everyone has to go to, is those are the only places where you gain true diversity outside of the public schools that aren't controlled by districts or by buses, whatever. So I don't know. Public schooling is important. Diversity is important. Diversity in thought is important. Send tweet.
And that's the podcast. No.
We do have more questions for you, though.
Can I just tell you real fast, Colby? So we were having a class discussion. These programs are new. So I'm working with today. I worked with a class that has three future math teachers and three future English teachers. And we had this discussion about addressing social issues in the high school classroom. You know, like, for example, we're talking about things that are related to anti-racism. You know, so is it an English teacher's place to talk about Black Lives Matter, to talk about the protests from earlier this year? Is it appropriate to teach Angie Thomas's The Hate U Give in the high school classroom? Because you're not just teaching, you know, reading skills or how to read literature. You're actually talking about the social issues. And is that the role of English? And my question to that student was, well, why wouldn't it be? You know, and there are actual legit answers for that, depending on, you know, how you feel and, you know, what kind of history of education you want to hook on to. But it's a legitimate question. You know, why is that something that we should or should not be discussing in the classroom? And there's really that's one of the big debates that we have about the soul of education is what is it that we want to happen? What should be happening?
So speaking of The Hate U Give, you are into YA.
Yeah.
You have done a lot of thinking and talking about and writing about young adult, new adult fiction. What is it about YA that that kind of gets you going?
Yeah. So first of all, you know, back in my day, young adult literature.
Oh my God. Yeah, how old are you?
Old enough. Back in my day, young adult literature was not like it is now. Okay. You just need to understand that. It has come leaps and bounds. And we won't name the person who probably gets the most credit for that. But yeah. Anyway, so I was. So this is the story. This is the story, and I've written about this. It exists. It's out there. I was teaching a 10th grade honors class, and my task for the day, because we team planned, there were several of us, we all had to do the same thing. My task was to teach this short story from the textbook. In order to have them understand the different ways that an author can use the skill of characterization. And, you know, I like to facilitate discussion in the classroom. I'm a dialogic person. That's what I care about. That's what my magnet school training gave me. So I was getting nothing from them because the story was not interesting to them. And frankly, they didn't care about characterization either. This was my second year teaching high school. And so one of the things that I had taken it upon myself to do was to try to understand the youth a little bit more. The summer prior, I had watched High School Musical.
Great movie, Karate yeah. Kid. Great movie. That's a throwback to a podcast that I was on with Sam.
but anyway, I'll tell you, and Martha, you'll really appreciate this. This is an origin story.
I do love those.
I read Twilight the summer before. And you know, I'm a completist. Like I was like, I don't what it but then I kept going.
Well, have we
going? I read all four of them.
Have you finished Midnight
summer.
Sun yet? Is that something we need to talk about?
No, I haven't read that yet. Is there anything in Midnight Sun that really tops the truly terribleness of New Moon when he leaves and you turn the page and it's like October?
Yeah, isn't that the best part though?
I mean, that's just peak whatever that is. So anyway, back to when I was in the classroom a few months later, and I'm just so frustrated about the whole characterization thing. It's just like, okay, all right, who's read Twilight? Hands go up, right? Like 2/3 of the hands in the class go up. And what was even better was like, I had said something interesting. I had their attention now. And I was like, okay, can somebody explain to me what the deal is with how Bella is so clumsy? Like, what's up with that? And so that just starts a thing, right? You know, so obviously the pro-con Bella thing just erupts. Just, it's like primordial. It was ready to come out. Like, it was in our collective unconsciousness, and Stephanie Meyer had to unleash it. Like, they just went. And I said, okay, why does that matter? Like, why does she need to put that in the book? Like, why, what does that do for us? And like, just, they just kept going. And I'm like, well, that's characterization. Now we're done. Okay, let's go back to the story. Which we did. Eventually. But the point is, you know, it was in that moment. I was like, okay, we're doing the wrong thing here. We're doing the wrong thing. Do we care about the thing that we're asking them to read? Or do we care about this skill set? Which, by the way, neither of which are the right thing. We should care about what we have the ability to read and how we can understand it and how that relates to our lives in general. So that's the right answer. But we really care about that skill set. Why does it matter what we're reading? Why can't they just read young adult literature if it accomplishes the goals of what we want? And so I'm certainly not the first person to come up with that idea, but that kind of gave me a purpose and eventually led me back to grad school to see everybody else who's been talking about it and then begin to put my own mark on that discussion, and hopefully we can eventually move the needle in public education in that way so that more people are reading things like The Hate U Give in the high school English classroom.
So how do you reconcile the kids want to talk about Twilight, because obviously the kids want to talk about Twilight, and also the higher education need to have familiarity with capital T, capital C, the canon?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
which is a problem, at least to me, in and of itself, but.
Well, right. And, you know, the thing about it is like, I like that. I like a lot of that stuff. You know, I just drag my student teacher because she doesn't like Shakespeare and she don't want to teach Shakespeare. I'm like, man, there are a few things better than teaching Shakespeare when you do it right. Like, she's getting handed the keys to Macbeth next week by her cooperating teacher. And I'm like, oh, geez, what an opportunity for you.
So Shakespeare has some bars, like, for real. Shakespeare was going in sometime.
And see, that's the thing. There's worth in those things, but if you don't have the buy-in from your students or the skill set as a teacher to have that discussion, then you might as well just not bother. And, you know, the thing about it is that I'm not attached to, and I haven't been for years, in the idea of the canon as something that we have to teach. It has value. Da Vinci, Rodin, Beethoven, Mozart. They have value still. They don't get taught in public school. Maybe they should. I actually told a professor one time of literature who's on my committee, said, you know, if I had my way, when we redo the high school curriculum, one thing that we will do is we will sever literacy from literature with a capital L, and you'll have the opportunity to take a course on literature, but you'll also have an opportunity to take a course on art, visual art. You'll also have an opportunity to take a class on music, classical, rock, I don't care. The point is, we need that humanities education in high school, and we need to expose students to art that they are unfamiliar with, and maybe that we're not that familiar with, from all places over the world. But that's not the world we live in. And if I'm having to compete for space in the high school, I'm going to stick with literacy. I need them to be able to read and write well. I need them to be able to see statistics online and be able to know what's legit and not legit. I need them to see what's a good source and what's a not credible source. I need them to understand how to read an explanation of benefits or their healthcare plan. I need them to have the literacy. And Shakespeare's not going to get me there. But I tell you what, if they're a little bit interested in reading because of young adult literature, I can get them to where they need to be in terms of literacy. So that's the answer there.
That makes me feel better about my life in general, because I am not someone who could ever really get behind those hefty tomes like Shakespeare or, I don't know, fucking Gilgamesh. I think that's what the AP Lit class read. But I love romance novels. I love YA novels. And that's just something I don't necessarily relate more with, but it's easier to digest. So I feel like that's very validating to hear as someone who likes to read, but feels bad because I don't read like the classics or whatever. So I don't know. Thank you for that. Also, we've totally veered like no more coronavirus, but that's okay.
We can talk about it if you want. I have to go back in to my home office next spring because I'm doing it all again next semester. I'm still not going back. Oh, I hate it. I wish I was. We were actually talking about fall 2021 scheduling, and I said, I am 1,000,000% committed to being face-to-face in the classroom, and I just hope we can do it. I don't like this at all.
I hope you can, too.
Just to give you a little more of that.
Yeah.
Full circle. Thank you for listening to this episode of Martha and Colby Grow Up with our special guest. Do we call you Dr. Sam? We didn't establish that at the beginning.
I mean, you can. Andy and Tessa still occasionally insist on it, but
all right. With our special guest, Dr. Sam, you can find us online on Twitter at Martha and Colby and on popculturishub.com. Shit, that was too good, Colby. Fuck it up.
No, I was just about to say, is that it? Did we do it?
I don't know. Fuck it up.
Bye.
Find us online at www.marthaandcolby or on Twitter and Instagram at Martha and Colby.
Thanks to Stephen Boyd and DJ Empirical for all things sound.
Thanks to Jordan from Dreamful Podcast for the artwork.
Shout out to Irene, even though you don't listen to this podcast.
Don't forget to rate us 5 stars and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, and we'll talk soon.
Okay. I think we're good. Sorry, my microphone's doing weird stuff. All right, never mind. I'm back.
Chase was a pop culture beast.